Hello, and welcome to this week's episode of the Cure Talks Cancer podcast. Each week, we'll be hearing from patients, survivors, caregivers, advocates, and healthcare professionals to do what Cure does best: provide cancer updates, research, and education. No one should have to face cancer alone. In fact, there are dozens of studies out there that suggest that married patients are more likely to survive cancer than unmarried ones. And it seems like sound logic, right? The conventional wisdom supports it if you just look at these common axioms. Together we can accomplish great things, happiness is only real when shared, and if you want to go fast, go alone, but if you want to go far, go together. There's just something about togetherness that really empowers us to be able to overcome the most imposing obstacles, even cancer. Now, for decades, physicians have combined the wisdom in these axioms with scientific evidence in the literature to justify statements like married patients with cancer have more fighting spirit. But for Joan Delfatore, an unmarried 73-year-old professor emerita of English at the University of Delaware who survived stage 4 gallbladder cancer metastasized to the liver, which, by the way, has a 2% chance of survival of more than a year, something just seemed a little bit off about conflating fighting spirit with the institution of conventional marriage. The idea seemed half right, you know, for placing a ton of value on support systems, but half wrong, too, for assuming that marriage was this gold standard of support. You see, Delfatore may not have a spouse or children, but that does not mean she doesn't have the so-called fighting spirit of a pack of wolves. Over a long career in academia, she's built deep, meaningful connections with extended family members, friends, and colleagues. They were the ones she tapped to support her following the cancer surgery that saved her life. But when Delfatore needed follow-up chemotherapy, she ran into a roadblock when her physician found out she didn't have a spouse or children to care for her. Now, the question arose, was this implicit bias or was it best practice on the physician's part? Was this happening to other patients too, or was this an anomaly? Delfatore pored through scientific studies to find out, and she answers those questions in her new essay titled Death by Stereotype: Cancer Treatment in Unmarried Patients. It was published in the New England Journal of Medicine September 5th, and today we welcome Joan Delfatore onto the Cure Talks Cancer podcast to tell her story so others might benefit. So Joan, thanks so much for joining us.
Happy to do it.
Your story is probably not unique. Odds are there are a lot of other people out there facing very similar hurdles. But it does seem to me to be a bit underappreciated, so let's talk this out. Can you walk us through your journey with cancer and explain the challenges you faced?
My cancer treatment started off very well. I had a diagnosis of stage 4 gallbladder cancer metastasized to the liver, which has a 2% chance of survival of more than a year. And it's generally considered inoperable. The chemotherapy keeps people alive for maybe 2 months longer than they would otherwise have lived. But I was fortunate to find a physician, a surgeon, at Memorial Sloan Kettering in New York City, who was willing to consider surgery. He did the surgery, and I knew he was pushing the envelope in the sense that this is a disease that normally is considered inoperable. And he was thinking in this particular case, it had features that perhaps surgery would be useful. So I knew that. What I didn't realize at the time was he also was accepting the fact that my support system is non-traditional. He did ask me a lot of questions about social support, and I told him about cousins who live in and around New York, about my friends back in Delaware, colleagues, neighbors, and he accepted that. But after the surgery, when I needed follow-up chemotherapy, I went to an oncologist who really got hung up on the fact that I do not have a husband and children. And he was proposing to give me much less than what I knew was the standard of care. He wanted to give me just one mild drug when the best chance was combination chemotherapy. And I was healthy except for the cancer. But when I asked him why, he said, oh, I wouldn't risk the side effects with someone in your situation. And as I say, he repeatedly kept talking about the fact that I don't have a husband and children. He kept saying, but how will you manage? So I went on to another oncologist who was more open-minded. She also asked about social support, but she was willing to accept friends, neighbors, colleagues. And at that point, it wasn't hypothetical. They had been there for me after the surgery, so I knew they would be. And she accepted that, whereas the other one had not. So when it was over, after the chemo was over and I was back on my feet, that just kept bothering me. What about that one who was going to give me such mild treatment, it would actually have affected my chance of survival? And he believed he was doing the right thing. So that's when I did the research to find out whether this was a one-time event, maybe he was just an outlier, or is there evidence that this is more widespread?
So what is the answer? What is your answer to that question?
It has wider implications for patients with non-traditional support systems. What I found, I did a keyword search to see what research is out there on the association between cancer care and marital status. I honestly went into it prepared to find nothing. I thought maybe no research had been done. What I was astonished to find was 84 articles going back more than 30 years. The first one I found was from 1987. For 30 years, it's been reported in the medical literature that if you show up for cancer care with a current spouse, your chance of getting surgery or radiotherapy is significantly higher than if you are widowed, divorced, separated, or never married. That's been in the literature for 30 years. Mm-hmm. And no one thought it was something that we needed to think about, because the authors in the discussion sections repeatedly said, well, of course this is happening because unmarried patients don't want stronger care. It's patient preference. The patients are refusing care. Now, this was without evidence. This is speculation. The patients are refusing care, and they don't have social support, and they're depressed, and they can't follow medical instructions. What I did for the article, and the reason the article was published, I did an extensive search of sociological and psychological literature on some unmarried patients to test whether those statements are in fact true. And what I found was massive, extensive evidence that these things are not true. And what's really striking is in some cases, the articles that say explicitly, you cannot reduce social support to any one factor, were the ones that were cited in these medical journals to prove the point that if you don't have a husband, you don't have, or if you don't have a spouse, you don't have social support. I'm wondering if the medical authors even read the articles, but that they were conflating social support with having a spouse. So they were reading these sociological and psychological studies that showed how important social support is. But those articles were defining social support as what church do you belong to, or religious group do you belong to? Are you a member of the Rotary Club? Are you active in your neighborhood? Are you friendly with people at work? It was a variety of things, and the medical authors interpreted that research as if it were only about whether you're married.
Now, when he was kind of pushing back on you about that social support question, what was going through your head while that was going on?
You know, honestly, I was a little off guard because I've spent my whole adult life on university campuses, where there's a lot of acceptance for a variety of different living arrangements. In a public university English department, if you want to attract attention because of your lifestyle, you have to do a lot more than just not have a husband and kids. So I wasn't ready for that. I hadn't lived in an environment where I ran into that all the time. I did not think I could win that argument. I did not take him on because he was so clearly convinced that I didn't think anything I said would change his mind. So the only solution was to move on to someone else.
What sort of advice do you have for patients who are going through a similar circumstance, let's say a cancer diagnosis, and they're up against a similar stereotype? How would you suggest that they approach these conversations with their physicians if they're similar to you, if they're single and they have a sickness, but they have the social support in other areas?
One thing I would suggest, it made a huge difference that I knew what treatment I was supposed to receive. I knew what the standard of care was. Now, that's not to suggest that a physician might not be absolutely correct in wanting to do something different with a particular patient. But if you have an idea what the standard treatment is for your condition, and the physician proposes something else, at least you know enough to ask the question. Can you tell me why you want to do that? I'm also a big believer in second opinions. No matter how compassionate or how confident the original physician sounds, especially with something serious, I think it's always a very good idea to see if someone else sees it differently or has a different idea.
Joan, what about from the other side of the table, right, from the physician's standpoint? How would you suggest that physicians defend against their own implicit biases? Because like you said, it seemed to you that this physician was truly doing what he thought was best, but it sounds like objectively now with the result that you've gotten, it probably wasn't.
Both the surgeon who did the surgery and the medical oncologist who gave me the more challenging combination chemotherapy, both of them asked functional questions. They did not say to me, do you have a husband, do you have children? They said, you are going to need someone to drive you X amount of time. Who will do that? You may need someone to come and stay with you. Who will do that? So if a physician asks the questions that the physician really needs to know, as long as it's a competent adult driving you, as long as it's a competent adult supplying your meals, that's really what the medical issue is, as opposed to, is it necessarily a spouse or a child who's doing that?
Yeah, and I figure as time goes on, they'll be running into more and more of those types of situations. So I imagine it'll require a little bit of flexibility on the medical community's part.
Those articles that I looked at seem to take it for granted that if you're married, you have social support. But to give an example, some of the authors of those articles whom I interviewed use the example of, suppose you need radiotherapy 5 days a week for 5 weeks. If you're not married, who's going to drive you? Well, how many spouses do you know who could take off work 5 days a week for 5 weeks?
Right.
You know, it's not the 1950s anymore when one spouse stays home. The fact that you're married does not necessarily mean that the other person can do everything all the time. A really important point for physicians would be to stop and think, what specific help is this person likely to need, and find out who is going to supply it, rather than starting from the other end with the physician's own assumption about who should be supplying it. It's actually rather dangerous to assume that I can give this patient harsh treatment that's going to have severe side effects because they're married, the spouse will take care of it, without bothering to find out whether in that particular marriage that's necessarily true.
So the social support is as important as the medical community believes it is, but they need to redefine what they think of as social support.
Exactly. I think it's not only the medical community, they're reflecting what goes on in the larger culture. And definitely the science is not supporting the statement that unmarried patients do not have social support. There is extensive research over the years showing that unmarried people are very likely to have strong ties to extended family, to community ties, to religious organizations, to civic organizations. And there's a book that was actually published just this past year that shows very clearly the effectiveness of non-spousal support. What's happening in those medical articles, those medical authors are expert on the oncology. They are not trained in sociology or psychology. When they make statements like unmarried people don't have the will to live, that is a personal belief they have picked up from the culture. They have inhaled it through their pores. Or when they say unmarried people don't have social support, it's something that they themselves believe. It's a social stereotype. They don't stop to think about it. They don't stop to do an extensive study of the literature in that area any more than they would look up how to spell a word if they thought they already knew how to spell it. It's what psychologists call implicit bias. For the person who holds it, it doesn't seem like a bias. It just seems like the way things are.
So what are the implications of this implicit bias for cancer patients?
There's a psychiatrist named Jonathan Metzl. He suggests the real problem is not that physicians hold implicit biases, because they wouldn't be human if they didn't. And implicit biases are actually useful in many respects. It is necessary to use those mental shortcuts. We should not be demanding that physicians don't have implicit bias, which is effectively what we're doing. The society seems to feel as if there is something wrong with a doctor who has these kinds of biases. Metzl's view is we need to put it on a completely different plane, where the point is getting it out on the table, talking about it, creating an environment in which physicians can safely think about what are my assumptions in this particular case, forming that habit of thought. What assumptions am I making here? Do I actually know that this is true?
Right. What is your key takeaway after this experience that you lived through and all the research that you've done thereafter?
That is a good question. I think my key takeaway is that we are dealing with ourselves and other people who are not infallible, who do form biases, who do make mistakes in judgment. And being angry about it or accusing is really not helpful. When you are faced with a situation of life or death, or faced with a situation where your health is at stake, you need to be aware first of your own feelings, your own reactions, where you yourself are being unreasonable, where you yourself are reacting out of a gut level emotion that really doesn't make sense. So I would start at home, before you start trying to deal with anybody else, to be aware, just as the physician has implicit biases, so does the patient. So in that spirit of openness, of non-judgmentalism, to look at what you are being told and see, does this make sense? Do I have questions to ask? It is absolutely okay to move on to another physician if you are not satisfied. I do a lot of speaking on this topic, and I'm amazed at how many people say that they would not get a second opinion because they're afraid of offending the physician. Reputable physicians generally do not object to getting a second opinion, and if they did, that isn't anything in comparison with what your life and your health. So I think the takeaway was to try to keep your own head in the game as much as you can, to understand that the other person may be fallible. You said when we were talking earlier, some people put physicians on a pedestal. The patient needs to be aware of those assumptions. Are you assuming that this doctor never makes mistakes, that if the doctor says something, even if it doesn't seem to make sense, it must be true? So to be aware of one's own assumptions as well as those of the physician, and to try to work something out between them, to have a conversation that brings out the points that are most important in keeping yourself alive and healthy.
Don't forget to subscribe to the Cure Talks Cancer podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and any other apps to hear every episode, or visit us at curetoday.com/podcasts. The Cure Talks Cancer podcast is the official podcast of Cure Magazine, your indispensable guide to every stage of the cancer experience. For more information, visit us at curetoday.com. Find us on Twitter @cure_magazine or Facebook @cure_magazine.